This episode brought to you by Beta Brand, the San Francisco-based source for crowdfunded clothing you can visit in person the next time you're in San Francisco, or stop by anytime online to shop bestsellers like dress pant yoga pants and now yoga jeans. And when you do, use the code SPIRIT20 to save 20% off anything on the site. But that's not the only reason we love Beta Brand. Oh no, our fandom does not stop at stretchy pants we can wear all day, no matter where we are. There are a great many other things you can do on the site, which is BETABRAND.com. Among them, you can use their Model Citizen tool to upload your own photo and then receive a custom link that makes it look like you are the main model on the homepage of their website. It's kind of a fun thing to share with family and friends on social media, leaving them to wonder whether they should congratulate you on your new and unexpected side gig or actually call your bluff. We're big fans of the company, what they do, and we think you will be too. So check them out at betabrand.com. Spirit of 608, episode 104. You're listening to the Spirit of 608 podcast. I'm your host, Lorraine Sanders. Keep listening for stories, tips, and advice from women at the forefront of fashion, entrepreneurship, sustainability, and tech. I call it best, and it's the future. Hey, hey, and welcome to today's show. I am thrilled to bring you a conversation with Catherine Hildebrand, the founder of Good Clothing Company, and as of this spring, Good Apparel. And I'll explain to you, we will explain to you during the conversation how they are connected, other than their similar sounding name, but they're connected in other ways as well. It's really interesting. Catherine is one of those multidimensional people in the fest space. She truly is somebody that is helping to create change in more ways than one. She's an industry veteran, a master tailor who comes to the fashion industry from the technical side. She actually started studying under a master tailor at age 16 and has gone on to do a great many things since then. Obviously, we are going to get into many of those in the chat about her company, whose core business is ethical, sustainable, and small batch production for independent designers. We like that around here. And the in-house brand they launched this spring, Good Apparel. Take one look at it at their website, weargoodapparel.com, and you're going to see the master tailoring expertise that Catherine is bringing to this. I'm just in love with so many of the pieces here. It's kind of one of those sites you go to for the first time and you're like, okay, God, now I want to buy everything. So visit at your own risk. You know what I mean? After the chat with Catherine, stick around for another of our Press Dope founding member mini episodes. Today, we're going to be talking with a fest founder that you really are going to want to have on your radar. She's coming out with not one, but two companies. It blows my mind every time I talk to her. I'm like, so you have two companies, and it's kind of amazing, and they are connected. So it's actually really appropriate that this is on, you know, an episode that has, like with Catherine, where her companies are connected. The guest of our mini episode, Laura Wittig, she's doing not a similar kind of business, but there's a similar connected thread between her businesses, and we're going to hear more about those after the show. I can tell you, you are going to love what she is doing to the everyday bag for women. Just to give you a teaser, because I'm so just into this idea, the linings zip out so that you can wash them. Because how many of us have crusty, just like horrific stuff in our bags? I know I do. And you can't, like, it's one of these things. It's like, once you hear somebody like Laura talk about it, you're like, why hasn't anybody done this? So guess what? She's doing it. And you're going to hear more about it and all of that after the show. You know, as you can tell, I love cool, quirky twists to garments and accessories. And that is something I often hype up when I'm talking about our rad episode and show sponsor, Beta Brand, the San Francisco-based source for crowdfunded clothing that you can find online at betabrand.com, BETABRAND.com. And also the place where you can always save 20% with the code SPIRIT20. And you know, if you listen each week, I call out different items, and usually I call out something that's got like this weird, interesting versatility to it or a functional twist. But this week, nope, not going to call out any kind of twist. I was looking on their site, actually not for a women's apparel or accessories. I was looking for the dudes because, you know what, right around the corner, we're getting close to June here. And it's Father's Day, and my dad, my dear dad, who actually listened to episode 100, if you've listened to it, you will hear me talk about how he was involved in the getting of my first job in a cigarette warehouse. And he had some choice commentary for me about how I had not fact-checked my story. Apparently, I may have massaged some of the facts, according to him. So maybe in a future episode, we'll have him come and explain what actually happened. But I've been thinking about Father's Day, and I actually have it marked on my calendar this week that I've got to get off of my butt and do something about it. So I was looking, because I have to buy stuff in advance and have all my ducks in a row, or else I leave everything to last minute. It's like either far, far in advance or like last minute for me. There's no middle ground. So I was thinking about this week, went on betabrand.com, immediately went to the guys section, the men's section. And you know what? There's the shirt that you got to know about. It's not something I'm going to buy for my dad because I don't think we're ready for this conversation, but this shirt is called the Banana Hammock. It's called the Banana Hammock. Let it sink in, because it's just one of those phrases that ever since I was like 8, it made me start crying with laughter, and I never matured. So if you have never matured, you could find a shirt that is right in line with your theoretical age as opposed to your biological age. And on this beautiful blue shirt, button down, short sleeve, perfect for summer, available in July when you order now. And there's a lot of bananas. The bananas are in hammocks, and it's actually a really sweet looking shirt, but also kind of a subversive conversation starter. So if you're looking for not boring gifts for the guys in your life, but you still want them to look fresh, pressed, and ready for summer, hit up betabrand.com. And when you do, don't forget, SPIRIT20 is there to help you out, 20% off anytime you shop. Now onto the conversation with Catherine Hildebrand, founder of Good Clothing Company and Good Apparel. Catherine, welcome to the Spirit of 608 podcast.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I'm excited to talk to you. Can you start us out by telling us, first of all, where you are and the name of your company and a little bit about what it does? Because it's a new kind of company. I look at it as kind of a hybrid. I don't know if that word sounds right to you, but it's different than a lot of businesses that I've seen out there. So I would love for you to just get us up to speed on what it is.
Sure. So it's Good Clothing Company, and we have two locations in Massachusetts. One is in Mashpee on Cape Cod, and that's where we're doing all of our development, pattern making, prototype building, sample making. We do small batch production, a lot of consultations, and we basically, in that facility, it's kind of like the brain of our company, and it's where we take designers who may have as little as a concept or an illustration and bring them through the entire process to go to production. And typically, as we all know, and as it should be, new designers are starting out with small runs. And so we do small batch production with minimums of 10 on Cape Cod. So there is this hybrid in the sense that we have Fall River that is traditional manufacturing. Our minimums there are a little bit lower than what you will find across the board in the industry, because we're a firm believer in not producing more than you need to produce. But there is a certain threshold, and you have to keep things within a certain window to make things workable. And so our minimums there are 500. And we're typically working with already established companies or designers who have actually graduated our floor in Cape Cod to take them to the next level and to do things in a sustainable way. And then the newest piece to our business model is our house line, and that's called Good Apparel. And so we're actually completely vertical with that process and running all of that production through Good Clothing Company on our Cape Cod facility, actually, because we're running very, very, very low runs on that and running based upon demand.
Okay, so it's really interesting because you have the B2B piece where you're working in one facility with smaller, newer, emerging brands, from what I understand, with the smaller, like lowest minimums. And then you've got a separate facility that's operating more traditionally, but still, you know, you're entertaining lower minimums than industry standard, right? But then you also have your own clothing brand that's right. A part of this as well. I'm sort of an outsider to the manufacturing space. I mean, I interview a lot of people, but I've never actually gone through the process myself with my own line. Is it necessary? Like, why do you have to have two different facilities, you know, with different minimum structures? Can you talk to me a little bit about why that is? And I'll tell you the reason I ask. It's because I think it's really confusing to people who are just getting into this endeavor of building a fashion brand, and they don't really understand how to navigate working with different producers and with different factory options. And so I thought if you were able to kind of break down for us, well, you can't do this here, you have to set it up like this, it might help us understand a little bit, you know, the reality of what people are facing when they go and try to build a brand from the beginning.
Sure. So it's important to note, though, that one of the things that we noticed was really, really, really missing in the manufacturing industry is small batch, or is the opportunity for these great designers that you're talking about who have really cool ideas, are so far along in the process, but just can't, you know, jump that one hurdle. They have nowhere to go. I mean, it doesn't make any sense for someone who is starting out to be overproducing or meeting minimums abroad that are ridiculous, take forever, and make absolutely no financial sense when you're trying to head out the door. It's also prohibitive. I mean, the reality is, how many designers out there who have a great idea even have that type of capital? I mean, typically they don't. So there's that piece, this prohibitive piece. And then there's also this responsibility piece. I mean, we look at what fashion and the production of fashion, particularly the onset of fast fashion, what that's done to us over the past, say, decade and a half or so, and what outsourcing has done, and this just environmental destruction that we've seen, this destruction of jobs and whatnot. And so how do we bring that back, and how do we change that? Well, we change the way the industry works. So I can understand why they're confused, because what's going on right now in the landscape of manufacturing is actually not the norm. And so typically with large-scale manufacturing, you're looking at minimums of whatever, of X, whatever that facility establishes makes sense for their costing. The reason is that the pricing is very different. You have, these are all done on time studies. You have to turn the product in X number of minutes and seconds to keep your doors open. And so it doesn't work unless there's a flow, and it doesn't work without massive cut and things of that nature. And you can do that and do it responsibly. But when you're heading out the door, going to a place like that isn't going to help you, because they're focused on that primarily. Some places might have some development available in that type of a facility, but that really is not the norm. And so you would either be working with a local seamstress who's got really great patterning skills to help develop you, or you would be coming to a small batch facility like we have on Cape Cod, where you have a team that is organized specifically to meet all of the development needs that you will have, which are taking your technical flat or your illustration to pattern, possibly assisting with sourcing. We don't source, but we do assist with it, working on proto development and sample development, grading, pattern modifications, and really bringing that illustration into a three-dimensional garment. And that piece of things is absolutely necessary to move on to any other step, whether you're making 3 or 3,000, you have to do that part. And so I think designers, you know, I don't think they have a lot available. That's part of the confusion. But the other part of the confusion is that they really just don't understand the process if they're new. And so we're here for that. We do consultations on that and do a give back toward future production, really to explain the process and save you thousands of dollars, because you'll be repeating things that you don't necessarily need to repeat. But my suggestion would be to, Maker's Row has a lot of things listed that are really sort of against the grain, and just do your research. I mean, it's not easy, but they're out there.
I love that you brought in Maker's Row. I think they're a great resource. So for people listening, we will be sure to put that in the show notes for the episode. If you want to check them out, you can find a link there. And one thing that I'm thinking about as we're talking is, this is like a big question, but I feel like we hear more and more these days about options for production in the U.S. And I know there are a lot of great facilities and people doing things like what you're doing. But then at the same time, I often hear from industry experts and designers alike that it's very hard still to produce in the U.S. I mean, I've even had people tell me, look, just to be frank, there's no way you can build a viable business, you know, over the long term producing domestically, because you will be beat out by the competition every single time. And then I've had other people say, no, you know, there's these whole new models coming out where it's actually possible in ways that it wasn't, say, 5 years ago even. But do you have any thoughts on that? I mean, why are we getting all of this conflicting information?
Yeah, I definitely, I have thoughts on that one for sure. Garbage. Of course you can produce in the United States of America. We were doing it forever, and I'm doing it every day, and I'm turning away a lot of work because we just do not have the capacity to run what's here. So it's out there. And, you know, it's a much bigger conversation than is manufacturing available. Consumer habits are changing. Business models are changing. We're seeing a lot of vertical businesses that are taking out a lot of the unnecessary middle steps that do cause a lot of the damage that we referenced earlier. We're seeing consumers that get it. They're going, hey, wait a minute, you know what? $14 for a hoodie makes zero sense to me. And they're breaking this down, and they don't want to be involved in purchasing something that was either harmful to a human being or harmful to the environment. And they're the one driving that boat. So is it doable in the U.S.? It is. I have a mill in Fall River that was the nation's hub of manufacturing. Largest manufacturing center in the United States of America. Ran manufacturing that would blow your mind. That entire region is completely, its history is rich with this. It's in these people's DNA. It's their heritage. It's their hope. It's everything to them. And so it's, how do we go about that? And are we competing with China, or are we competing with this? No, we're not competing with that. There's no reason to. We don't want to, and we can't. What we're looking to do is work with and engage with designers who have the same ethos or the same perspective that we're seeing is the new trend. And the new trend is responsible purchase, responsible production, responsible consumption. That's our market. We're not interested in the other market.
Well, and do you think, I mean, on that note, talking about the ethos behind brands, I know that that's who you work with and who you attract, and how you're building your own house line as well. I mean, do you think that there's a argument to be made that, you know, what being a fashion business today, like a successful fashion business today, needs to mean, and what it's going to mean in the future? Because, you know, in the past, it's all been about growth and how many stores can you be in and how many wholesale accounts can you have, and you know, how affordable can you be and all this stuff. And I see a little bit of maybe that shifting, and maybe we're getting a different model for what success is. I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely, it's shifting. And, you know, and I'll tell you a little story about, from a personal perspective, as to why that actually needs to shift. And I'm glad that it is. We talk about the consumption that, you know, say we had in the 80s and early 90s that was just insane. You know, we went from this, our closets might have, say, three or four really special pieces. And I kind of remember when my dad would, or my mom would break out, you know, the JCPenney catalog back in like the late 70s and early 80s. And you had like this one budget, you know, and I think at the time mine might have been $100. And that was how you were going to clothe yourself and for the entire school year. And so you're really mindful about what you bought. And it meant something to you. And slowly, as we devalued all of that and things shifted, this whole consumer pattern and behavior pattern changed. And we got this throwaway mentality. And I will tell you that even I am guilty, have been guilty of that back in the day. But what I saw in my own personal field, you know, I've been a master tailor and in this industry for 31 years, and primarily have spent the majority of my professional history as a tailor. And I started at a time when the clothing still was valued. We were definitely, there was no such thing as like the internet or anything like this. It was a very different thinking at the time. And we valued what we had and we were willing to invest in that. And we wanted to preserve it and we wanted to keep it clean and free of damage because we weren't going to get another one. You know, we went to the cobbler, things like that. And I worked and started in the industry during that time. And when things shifted, we started to devalue our clothing. It became very disposable. And what happened by virtue of that is we began to devalue all of the people, not intentionally, but all of the people or all of those who were involved or laid hands on that clothing. And that was pre-production, during production, and then post-production, right? Because why are you going to pay somebody $10 to have a pair of pants when they only cost you $9.99? And so the argument about a human being's value was completely relative to the cost of a garment. And that person didn't get to establish that. So what we're seeing now, and this was going on for years and years and years and years, and a big part of the reason why we opened Good Clothing Company. But what you see when that happens is you see this just destruction of really all of these communities, micro communities, professions, trades, and hope goes away and all of these terrible things happen. And so what we're seeing now, thankfully, and certainly what's at the core of what we do is you've got to rip business of old down, right? Like you've got this massive business. Let's take it all apart. Let's find all of the little elements that got you to this big business. Let's go back and let's look at each one of the elements that was involved in getting you to the big thing. And what can we change about that? What about that is destructive? What about that doesn't make sense? Maybe we need to multiply this one by three because that one does a beautiful thing. We need to take this thing all away altogether. We need to handle this one more responsibly. I don't know why we were sourcing from there. That makes no sense, right? You just go down to all the pieces and then you rebuild. And what you're rebuilding really is the way you go about it. And you're thinking about, you're mindful. You're thinking about the effects that this is going to have short term and long term. What is it that we're doing as a business just in the, you know, say where Good Clothing Company is concerned? What are we offering and what are we doing that's supportive of responsible business growth for ourselves and for our clients? I think if we're all thinking like that, we see a massive change, right? Because it's like the snowball effect, you know, it begins to be a really big snowball and you see people joining in and we're stronger in numbers. So yeah, I do. I definitely think we have to think about it on every single level. We have that responsibility.
Well, and if only more big brands would actually go through the process of doing that work. I mean, you're talking about breaking down the in sort of interior like workings of their business in a way that you might break down a garment. And I would love to see that happen. I don't think that it is happening enough. I mean, that's why I get so excited about the smaller brands and the people that you work with in, you know, your Cape Cod facility, that type of customer where they really are nimble enough to change things or start right from the beginning.
Yeah, I think that the larger brands, it's tough. You know, they've got this huge behemoth that they've, you know, they've got to address. And it saddens me to see some of the decisions that are made when you know darn well that certain things could be changed. I think we each have the opportunity to focus on our one contribution. And I think so, like focus on that and do the right thing and be hanging with the, you know, the people that are doing the right thing. And then together you're creating that change. We can only lead by example. I mean, really, I truly, truly believe that. And then call out, you know, those who aren't. I mean, and make them accountable. Ask them to be accountable.
I love that. I love that, you know, you're talking about you can only really affect what you're doing. I mean, yes, you can help influence what others are doing. But, you know, there's a lot to be said for being focused on how you're doing things and just keeping going ahead one foot in front of the other every day to make that happen. I'd love to get into your background a little bit because we've talked about your business. When I was doing research to have you on the show, you know, I found a lot of stuff about your business out there, but I didn't really find very much about you. And I'd like to tell listeners who you are. So can you tell us a little bit about how you got to, you know, the Master Tailor piece of your life? I mean, where did you grow up and why that path?
Sure. kind of grew up all over the place. I was a military brat. My dad was a Navy officer. I was born in San Francisco and have lived as far south as Louisiana, lived as far north as Maine, all up and down the East Coast, lived overseas. And we moved, oh my gosh, almost every year. So I'm really from nowhere, but from everywhere. And my traveling and the way that we grew up just, I guess, kind of molded me. And it was somewhat nomadic for, well, definitely for all of my formative years. And then most of my late teens and early 20s, I started out in the industry because I was absolutely just smitten with fashion from as young as I can possibly remember. I talk about my journey beginning when I was 16, apprenticing under an Italian tailor. But the truth is that my journey probably began at about 8 years old when I laid my sister on a piece of fabric and traced her out to make a pattern. So she was a guinea pig for a lot of my early creations. But, you know, my love for fashion, my love for art, my love for illustration led me to wanting to do more with that. And I was really creative and always questioned things and ripping things apart and making things, but I needed to know more. And I had a great opportunity to apprentice and took advantage of that opportunity and made next to nothing for quite some time and walked to work every day to get that done. And started on my journey and opened my first tailoring shop in my very early 20s. And was a tailor up until, well, I still am, but was an active tailor up until 3 years ago. But the truth is that the majority of my life for the past 25 years has been being a mom. And as newsworthy as I think that is, there wasn't a lot written about what I was doing, raising my kids and working as a tailor. That's my history. And I, at some point, started getting very frustrated and angry with what was going on in our industry. And my kids got old enough so that I could begin to do some of the things that I wanted to do, but life really just wasn't going to let me do while I was raising them. And I went out and started Good Clothing Company. I had a modest clothing line before that, but started Good Clothing Company and just hit the ground running.
So I think that's really fascinating. And I try, like, I'll say this, you know, I try when I know women are mothers to not zero in on that aspect of their life, because oftentimes I feel like it's not something I would ask a guy. You know, I got really like trying to be sensitive about doing what Jessica Herron, the founder of Stella and Dot, referred to as lady viewing. So like instead of interviewing you, like asking right. you a bunch of female related questions. Since you brought it up, I'm really curious, and I guess I'm just going to like lady view you for a second, because I'm a mom, and I know a lot of people listening to the show are moms and or thinking about becoming moms in the future. And, you know, I think it's a special thing to go through the process of raising your kids and then after that say, you know what, like, no, I'm going to get, not necessarily get back in the game, but I'm going to like turn up the volume on my game and do something really different here. A lot of people don't do that. Was there something in you that gave you the confidence to do that or made you feel like, yes, I can have this whole next phase of my life? Like, what helped you get into that mindset and push forward?
Well, a number of different factors. So it's important to note that I was a single mother and have been a single mother for a number of years. So I worked and I worked my tail off. Trust me. But I wasn't free to, you know, I worked and then I went home because my children were my priority. And still, you know, my son is still at home and he still is my priority. But he's at an age now, you know, you get to a point where you realize that they just don't need me in the way that they needed me at once. And, you know, he still needs me. It's very frustrating to him if I'm not there to make dinner, primarily because he wants to know that I'm home. He really actually doesn't want to spend any time with me, which is totally fine. I mean, honestly, I am the least interesting thing in his life, but it's very comforting to him to know that I'm home. So I still have to balance that a little bit. But what got me to get going? Well, I realized I kind of could, because no one was going to drown in the bathtub or die of starvation because I wasn't there to make them lunch. That was part of it. But the biggest part of it is that I was really pissed off about what was going on in this industry. And I had the time and the determination and a bunch of great women around me who were just as irritated as I was. So I'd like to tell you that there was a big come to Jesus moment for me. But the truth of the matter is I was able to finally, and I was angry. That's the truth.
Well, I think that is solid reason to do it. And, you know, but I like what you're alluding to as something I've been thinking about a lot lately, which is sort of the idea of these different seasons in your life. And sometimes it is a great time to move forward with a new venture, and sometimes it's not. And, you know, I think, you know, I was out in the Bay Area in California for a long time, and the sort of idea out there of hustle and just move fast and break things and all of that stuff. You know, I have a little bit of a contrary opinion to that, where it's not always the best time to try to move fast and break things. You know, sometimes it's not a good time to be taking big business risks in your life because of everything else that your life is. And so I'm just glad that you shared that, because I think that it'll be really helpful to people listening who are grappling with, well, is it the right time to do this? And, you know, will I have time to do it later if right now isn't the right time?
Right. So there's this one song. I don't know how many people are a big fan of Ray LaMontagne, but this one song that I quite like by him, and it's called Be Here Now. And I'm always reminding myself, like, be here wherever that moment is in my life. And you instinctively know, right? Sometimes be here is a very simple period of your life. And sometimes it's very complicated, but being in that moment and understanding that you're in that right moment, and you're not trying to be in another moment. The other moment will come.
So we've talked a little bit about you. I kind of wanted to bring it down to a real in the weeds question that I always like hearing what people have to say to this. You do a lot of things in your business. And we talked a little bit about this before the show. I mean, you set up your schedule in a certain way. And can you walk us through what a typical day is like for you? Because I was kind of fascinated with how you set things up and how you were talking about, you know, what Fridays are to you versus the rest of the week and that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Okay. A typical day in my life. Well, it starts at 4 a.m. 7 days a week.
4?
Yeah.
How do you get up at 4? I'm sorry. What time do you go to bed?
Anywhere from 9:30 to midnight.
What? Wow. Okay. Goals. That's my
goals. No, not yet. Not even. I wish I could tell you that I actually had to work at that, but I don't. It's a very natural rhythm for me. I'm an early riser. I like to be up early, and I kind of need to with what I'm doing. So it starts at 4 a.m. Immediately coffee, immediately. That's the first thing. And then I go straight into communication, answering emails. I run books. I balance all of my bank accounts every morning between 4 and 5. And then I go into breakfast preparation, meal preparation for my son, and then we have a drive to high school. And then I come back and set up my calendar for the morning, hop in the shower and head to work. And then the day looks typically like interviews, consultations, client meetings, planning, vetting new clients. I do a lot of production application reviews, scheduling. It's all kind of all over the place. We're in development with Good Apparel quite frequently, so we'll have design meetings over that. I do quality control check-ins with our staff, constant check-ins with our team in Fall River. Oftentimes means I'm back and forth between facilities. It's a lot of stuff, a lot of different things that we do during the day, but it always begins at 4, and one day I could be at a machine. It's rarely the case anymore. Another day I could be at the state house pushing for hemp legalization. I could be on the floor moving machines around because we have a new production run in Fall River and we're setting up cells for that production. It's very, very varied. Very, very varied, very varied.
Well, it sounds fascinating. And I hope your kids, if they ever, I mean, they probably, I don't know if they like to listen to podcasts, but I hope that they will understand someday how much of a badass their mom is, because that's just, it's no joke. So I'm glad you walked us through that.
Thank you for that. I'm going to play this back to my son.
Well, sorry, Tom, sorry.
I'm going to say.
High school, they use bad words, so who cares? It's fine. But we're coming up on the end of the time we have together. And before I go into the questions I always ask guests at the end of every show, I wanted to know if you could give us some advice or tips or just things that if a new entrepreneur, a new designer comes to you, like, what would you want them to be thinking about? Are there any things that you think they would need to just core bottom line things they need to have in place before they can consider going into production with a facility like yours? Advice you'd want to leave them with?
Absolutely. Have a plan. Somewhat of a business plan, but have a plan. Understand what your short-term goals, what your long-term goals are, have them written down. How many pieces do you have in your collection? That should be defined. Establish your budget. Nothing happens without a budget. You need to know what your budget is. And if your budget is $1,000, it's $1,000. Let's find what pieces we can do within that budget. Have your technical flats in place or illustrations in place. Know, have your sourcing in place. Understand where you're going to get your textiles. The biggest thing, do your homework. You don't have to know everything, but you have to have a solid plan and it needs to be mapped out. And so when someone asks you what the next step is or what it is that you're using for this or that or the other, you can answer that question. There's nothing more frustrating than getting an email, I have a great idea, help me bring it to life. That's frustrating. We want to work with people who are serious. We are here as an advocate for our clients. We are here to help you. We believe in what you're doing, and we need you to make the same investment in the process that we're going to make in you.
That's great advice. Thank you for bringing it into the show. So to close out, a couple of questions. Are there any tech tools, apps, books, resources, or just a low-tech, great piece of advice that has helped you kick ass in your daily life that you think would help our listeners kick more ass in their day lives?
I wish that I had really new groundbreaking advice for you here, but I'm going to tell you the truth about what helps me kick ass in my daily life. And it is this massive paper calendar that I have on my desk. I'm extraordinarily organized and I do everything on that calendar on pencil so I can move things around. And I actually carry it with me everywhere I go. Like, it's huge and it's obnoxious, but it honestly is what keeps me on track. That is one thing for business. QuickBooks is an obvious. It helps to keep me in line with sales goals. I can consistently track and see where I am financially with my business, where we need work, where we have red flags. And then, of course, you know, we use social media and that helps a lot with marketing. I think Instagram might be one of our new faves.
Wonderful. So we have not met in person, but if we were to hang out all day, what do you think that I would end up absolutely loving about you? And what do you think would drive me insane?
I'm extremely generous. I think that you would quite like the fact that I am very, very generous and very compassionate. I will give you a lot of candy. I'm always giving people chocolate. I am a very good listener. So I think you would like that. I think I would absolutely drive you insane with my obsessive need to be organized and on task. It's frustrating, I think, to those who work around me, but it serves a purpose, but it's annoying.
I'm always inspired by extremely organized people because I wouldn't categorize myself in that way. So I always, you know, I like to be around super organized people for limited periods of time.
Right.
Where I can get the, you know, feed off them and it's inspiring if, you know, but
right.
Not so long that they try to reform me.
Right. And then you can leave and go home.
Right.
Yeah.
So
I am that woman.
If you had to print a phrase or a motto on a t-shirt and wear it around for the next 7 days, what would it be?
Probably bring it. Yeah, bring it. I mean, I like challenges and we're consistently trying to defy the traditional model. And so if we get a challenge, there's nothing I love more than proving something can be done.
So I always close out by asking guests if you have a question you'd like to ask me, anything silly or serious, and I promise to give you an honest answer.
Yeah, I would actually probably have two, but if I were to pick the one that I would prefer to know, it would be, what is your favorite dish that you cook and who taught you to cook it and why is it favorite to you?
You know, that is such a funny question because it's like the favorite that I would make just for myself is different than the favorite I would make if it was for other people. So one thing that I find myself doing a lot is making traditional sort of family recipes when there's some kind of like gathering going on. I don't know. It's funny. Like I always go back to that stuff that my mom made. So she has a breakfast casserole that, I mean, anybody that knows me that's either stayed at my house or come over on the weekend in the morning has probably been served this sausage casserole that my family's been making for like decades.
That's awesome.
That's probably the favorite. But then if I was making something for myself, one of my favorite recipes is this one that it's black beans, mango, and cucumber in a salad. And then you make a dressing out of sun-dried tomatoes and oil and vinegar, and I think there's some honey in it. Anyway, you mix it all up and you let it sit in the fridge for like, you know, a couple hours, and it is so good. I just can't, it's like a filling meal type salad. So
if I head to your neck of the woods, that would be what I would want to eat.
the bean salad. Well, my friends are like kind of, I mean, there was an era in my life where we had a lot of like backyard barbecues and they'd be like, here she comes again with the bean salad, because it was my one, you know, it was the one thing I like that
as,
you know, one trick pony. So thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your story with us and more about what you're working on. If listeners want to keep up with you and all the great things you have coming out this year, what is the best way for them to connect with your company online?
So they can go to goodclothingcompany.com. If they're looking for anything to do with manufacturing, sign up for our emails. You'll get emails with updates, certain new things that we're doing in the industry. And then Good Apparel, it's weargoodapparel.com. Follow us on all of our social media channels, obviously, Twitter, you know, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, all of that. We're on all of those and we're pretty active there. So there's a lot to see.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for sharing that. And I so enjoyed chatting with you and I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Thanks so much. You too.
Done and done. I had such a great time talking to Catherine. I hope any of you interested in domestic manufacturing will check her out. The next time you're trying to figure out if that's feasible for you and your brand, they do a great work. And their new line, Good Apparel, is an excellent representation of it. Speaking of new lines, the forthcoming Kennebecker line is on the horizon from Laura Wittig, who is a founding member of Prestope. And we wanted to thank her for her support and what we're doing by bringing her on the show and letting her fill us in before everybody else gets to hear about it, about all the good things that she has coming out later this year. So here we go, Laura Wittig of Kennebecker and Brightly. Laura, welcome to the Spirit of 608 podcast.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, I'm excited to chat with you and bring you onto the show today. So can you start us out by telling us where you're based and what the name of your business is?
Sure. So I'm based in the Bay Area, particularly Oakland. And my business, Kennebecker, is a company that's dedicated to helping women accomplish whatever life throws at them via the use of a multifunctional messenger bag.
Okay. And from what I understand, you also have a second company in the works that is super stealth, but is there anything you can tell us about that as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm also working on something called the Brightly Collective, which is going to be a curated marketplace for sustainable goods. And really the thought behind that process is that we really want to empower people to use their purchasing habits for good and make sure that makers are able to have their products in front of people who are excited about buying them.
Okay. And it's interesting because I know that you've had some experience with e-commerce and the whole idea of social good. Where were you before you were working on these companies? Can you tell us a couple of the places that you have worked in the past?
Yeah, sure. So I previously had worked with Google and Amazon. I was employees at those companies in two really different areas. So when I was at Amazon, I worked in the fashion space, particularly email marketing around shoes, handbags, and apparel. So I did a lot of customer segmentation, targeting people on Amazon who may or may not have been exposed to the fashion space. So that was a super interesting, fun role. And then I actually went to work for Google in the social impact search space. So my job there was, again, user targeting and user research, but actually trying to use that research for good and help people when they came to Google to look up crisis hotlines. So be that suicide prevention, sexual assault prevention. My job was really to make sure that people found the help they needed when they came to Google.
And now as you're working on Kennebecker, tell us a little bit about the bags themselves. How are they different from other handbags out there in the world today?
Absolutely. So the idea for the signature Kennebecker bag was born when I lived in Seattle. When I was working at Amazon, I was in a constant downpour all the time. So I struggled to find a bag that was water resistant, that could protect my laptop, and also allowed me to store other things in there that looked chic. So I was looking at like men's briefcases and was sort of not excited about them. So what I ended up doing was using an old British fishing bag, which had water resistant canvas and really felt like it was something that I could use every day and also take out with me and look, you know, looked pretty chic and sort of heirloom inspired. So the issue with that bag was that it was truly designed for throwing fish in it. So I needed to sort of finagle it and make it to where it was something that I could wear every day and I'd be excited to, you know, sell to people. So I actually ended up making sure that the interior lining was detachable. So that I think makes it super unique as well. So if you spill something, if you're a mom and want to use the Kennebecker bag as a diaper bag, you can actually just throw whatever you need to in there. And if something spills, you just take the liner out and throw it in the wash. So to me, I really wanted to make sure that we had something that was multifunctional, chic, and really protected whatever gear you had necessary.
Yeah, you had me at removable lining. I don't think I've ever seen a bag that has done that. And it's, I don't, now that I'm hearing it, I'm like, why not? Like, that's so cool. So I'm excited to see this come out later this year. Now, you're in the stages of getting this business up and running, and you'll be debuting it later this year in the spring and maybe early summer. You know, it's not an easy process starting a business, right? And what is it about what you're doing that keeps you going even during the really tough moments that every entrepreneur faces?
Absolutely. And when we were chatting earlier, I was talking about the challenges that come from trying to get something made sustainably and manufactured in a way that I was proud about. And I've been doing this, trying to get this business off the ground for a little bit now. And you're right. As I go through the motions, if you will, I just keep thinking to myself, whether it's for Kennebecker or for Brightly, I keep thinking what I'm doing is going to help change the world in its own small way. And the more momentum that I can help provide either consumers or inspire other makers to do something sustainable, I think if we use our purchasing power for good, we can really help make a dent. So that's kind of what keeps me going.
So as you're trying to get the word out about what you're doing, what's really worked for you? What's the last thing that you did that you thought, hey, that was really worthwhile?
Yeah. So for me, it's been really doubling down on my Instagram game. So being in the tech space, I've been on Instagram for a long time, but I've never really employed certain strategies to help grow my following. And so I think one thing that I've been trying to do is utilize, people talk about this tool a lot, but it's called Planoly. It lets me, I don't actually schedule posts. I just like to take my photos that I'd like to upload and see them in a visual way to help make the feed look more cohesive. I used to try and do that like just sort of in my head, and I never was super satisfied with it. So I took the plunge, got a Planoly account, and I've found some really great success there. And I've also just been trying to make sure that I'm commenting and engaging with people, and I'm seeing really strong engagement results. And I think that's one thing that I like to try and convey to people when I'm just like chatting with them and networking, is that even though you might have a small following, if you really have a high engagement, that's going to really point to a brand that people are excited about. And you know, whether that's, you know, something that you're really focused on is something that I think is really key.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're spot on there. And I mean, I've really noticed at the beginning of Instagram's sort of rise to being like this key thing that everyone in the fashion space had to do, I think people really thought it was all about posting more pictures. And I think some people still think that's how you grow your account. But really, like you're saying, it's more about commenting and being involved and engaging with other people's accounts. And then it comes back to you. And I know I follow your account, so I feel like I've seen that happen.
Oh, yeah. Thanks.
Yours. Okay. So what is one great tool, tip, or piece of advice that other Fest founders really need to know about right now?
Yeah. I mean, so in addition to Planoly, I actually have been super inspired by a post that you put out. Actually, I think it was one of your podcasts, about utilizing the power of Upwork and Fiverr. So those are two platforms that you can go to help outsource some work. So there's never time in the day. And oftentimes, if you're not familiar with a particular process, or you know, maybe you just don't have time to get to certain tasks, I think leaning on some extra help in the form of contractors has been huge. So for instance, I was struggling with trying to get a tech pack created for my brand, found somebody on Fiverr. She was able to do it in 2 days for like a third of the cost that I was trying to get sourced through a friend of a friend. So highly recommend that.
Could not be more on board with those suggestions. Yeah, I use Upwork. I mean, it's like the reason that my business could even exist. So, okay. Do you have any special news or anything else you'd like to share with Spirit of 628 listeners?
I'm really excited about my upcoming launches, and I love the community that I found. And this is totally not scripted plug, but I love the Spirit of 608 community. I think it's a huge help to my business. And so I just wanted to thank you so much for fostering that space for founders and people who are interested in sustainable fashion, you know, and fest to come.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. And I'm glad that you're into it. That was my hope, that people would want to get together. So how can we keep up with you online? I mean, you have a lot of cool stuff coming out later this year. If people are listening to this and they want to connect with you and be able to know when you're launching, what's the best way for them to track you down and interact with you?
Absolutely. I think right now it would be on Instagram. I post a lot of announcements and you can get to my product landing pages. So my Kennebecker following is at It's Kennebecker is the handle. And then for the Brightly Collaborative, which I talked about earlier, that handle is at The Brightly Co.
So The T-H-I-T-H-E Brightly Co.
Yep.
Okay. And then Kennebecker, can you spell that for us so we have that?
Absolutely. It's K-E-N-N-E-B-E-C-K-E-R. So kind of like Kennedy, Kennebecker. And actually, fun fact, that's German for knapsack. So that's where that name comes from.
Ooh, I love that. Well, thank you so much for coming on and telling us a little bit more about you and what you have in the works this year. I've so enjoyed getting to know you over the last couple of months. And yeah, I wish you all the luck in the world. And we'll be following you on Instagram.
Thanks.
I don't know about you guys, but I get so excited about all this festive stuff that's happening. If you want to get excited about festive stuff that's happening, connect with people like Laura and other founders who just get it. You can join us as a Presto member once we open back up in June. That's right. At the moment, we're sold out of all of the memberships other than just a couple of the high gear, but we'll be reopening with new features and new pricing in June. If you'd like to stay up on what's happening and be the first to know before we tell others about it, you can sign up to get notified on prestope.com/pricing. There is a link there. If you click out a stock link, you're going to end up getting directed to a page where you can give us your email. And in exchange for your email, we will make sure that you are first in line when we come back out with what we're coming back out with in June, which is like literally days away, which raises my blood pressure a little bit. But you know what? It's going to be awesome. I'm really excited. Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. If you like what you hear, you can help us out by rating, reviewing, and subscribing to the show in iTunes or your favorite podcast player. And I hope you will join me next time for another conversation with a woman at the forefront of fashion entrepreneurship, sustainability, and tech. As you know, I call it FEST, and it's the future.